Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe, that's Central Iowa's premier good food store, and bringing together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. If you're looking for quality foods with a community focus, check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry, a residential commercial land. Joe's been covering all of that for over 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Contact Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. As always, folks, thank you to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Okay, so I want to start with a piece of history that I wasn't aware of, thanks to an article by Bill McKibben. It's about whale oil. He was recently visiting the, I guess he gave a talk at the New Bedford Whaling Museum and wrote about how whale oil grew to this huge industry back in the 19th century. It was like one of the prime sources of energy back then. And then along came, and that was facilitated by sort of key developments, which, I mean, to me right now seem horrible. A swivel harpoon was developed to make it easier to have that thing stick in the whale. The whale couldn't shake it, died more easily, more reliably. they also figured out how to build a fire pit for melting whale blubber in the bottom of a wooden vessel. So I'm not sure I'd want to be on that vessel with a fire raging in the bottom, melting whale blubber. But so, that was a primary source of energy, of heat, light. And then in around 1850 or so, oil was discovered in Pennsylvania. And that, of course, started the Black Gold Rush. And I'll read you what Bill McKibben wrote about that. Quote, so what did the whaling industry do? Did it pool all its resources and try to elect a president who would ban oil drilling on land? Did it get one of its own appointed Secretary of the Interior so he could shut down all hydrocarbon exploration on public lands? Did they persuade the White House to use coercive tariffs to ensure a foreign market for their product? Did they print up a whole lot of government posters showing strong and manly whalemen in an effort to sway public opinion? That's good stuff, Bill. No, they used their riches to get into oil. And I mean, again, none of this feels good right now, except that maybe because of the switch to oil, we still have whales on the planet. they were being endangered back then. So New Bedford had to switch gears. It actually became a kind of somewhat of a rundown place for a while, but they learned a while back to jump on the wind energy industry. So specifically offshore wind. But now, yeah, and they've gone, that's been great stuff for their economy, for their town, for their energy system. And they've now, of course, though, they're running into opposition from the Trump administration, who have been trying everything they can to put the brakes on wind development, even banning installations that, in one case, off the coast of New England, the one that was already 80% developed. So, and all this, of course, is being done at the behest of the oil industry. The oil industry basically helped pay for Trump's election. And instead of innovating, like the New Bedford did back in the 1850s, they've decided to just hunker down and try to keep their dirty energy going for as long as possible. So Bill writes about that, quote, the irony is that the actual whalers gave ground just in time to save many of the species they'd been hunting from, you know, hunting into extinction. Would that their spiritual heirs in the fossil fuel industry recognize the even greater tragedy stalking the planet at present? So, you know, we can blame Trump, but again, we got to blame the fossil fuel industry as well, because they could shift. And we have seen some shifts, for example, here in Iowa. Mid-American Energy, you know, I'm not a huge fan of big centralized energy monopolies, but they've done a lot to expand into wind energy. And again, conceding that wind energy has its own challenges and problems. But, you know, the market and the reality is already making it easier to, or attractive even, or even, you know, more cost effective to move into wind and solar and geothermal and whatnot. But, you know, with the federal government now, of course, continuing the subsidies for oil and coal and natural gas and putting all kinds of penalties on wind and solar, well, you know, it's not something you would have saw back in the 1850s. And, you know, to make it clear where President Trump stands on the broader issue of climate change and energy, and I'll read you a quote. If you go back in history, you'll find that the biggest tornadoes we've had in this country took place in the 1890s. You know, Trump wrote that, and actually that's not true. He said, quote, and the most hurricanes occurred in the 1860s and 70s. That's also not true. And he wrote, violent climate changes are nothing new. We have even had ice ages. I guess that's partially true. We do have ice ages, but we haven't had one in the past 160 years. And that's the time frame we're looking at in terms of the impact on global warming. Oh, and he gets away with saying things, I mean, one after the other. One lie, misstatement, you know, inaccurate representation after the other. People need to be paying attention to this stuff and calling him to task on it. So, again, it's billionaires in the oil industry and other industries that are really the beneficiaries of the Trump administration. And we've seen billionaires that formerly were somewhat critical of Trump either coming on board or, you know, more, you know, stepping a little more softly. I had a conversation this week with a Christian conservative friend, and we disagreed on a bunch of things. For example, the rapture. I'm not really on board with the rapture. we also disagreed on what's the most important book in the Bible. He asked me if I read the Bible. I said, yeah, I've read it twice. Once I read an entire chapter in Hebrew when I was studying Hebrew in college. For him, I think the most important book is Revelations. And he sees lots of things coming into play because of Revelations. Me, it's the Gospels and some of the prophetic texts. But we both agreed that billionaires are in charge of both major political parties in this country. And actually, I didn't lead with that. He led with that. He said that was his perspective. And I said, yeah, I totally agree. I've never been a fan of billionaires, but I did support one once running for president. And that was Tom Steyer. It was a tough call because I'm immediately, instinctively saying, oh, billionaire, no, thank you. But I went into that election in 2020 saying, I'm going to support the candidate who is the most solid on addressing climate change. And originally it was Jay Inslee, the former governor of Washington State, but he dropped out. And then it was pretty clear it was Tom Steyer. So I supported him. And, you know, despite having him over and his wife over and his daughter over, I think three different times in our home, and despite them saying, hey, we're going to keep in touch. Yeah, well, it's been pretty much crickets since then. And I guess I should expect that from a billionaire. But so I'm going to stick with what I've been going with for decades. And that's really, there's no such thing as a good billionaire. You don't get $1 billion. You don't earn, quote, earn $1 billion or get $1 billion inherited from your daddy or mommy. You don't get that without something wrong having to happen along the way. There's no way in any kind of democratic system of governance or even natural order of life where that much concentration of wealth happens in one person, one family. And, you know, they're both political parties have their billionaires. Republicans have some they love. Elon Musk, well, maybe they don't love him anymore. I don't know. But Democrats tend to love Bill Gates, you know, George Soros. You know, and Gates, Gates owns, this is a good reminder, and this is, again, I think we should all be able to come together on this. Gates owns 270,000 acres of U.S. farmland, over a quarter of a million acres of U.S. farmland. I don't know, you know, how do you wrap your mind around that? Okay, that's a third of the size of Rhode Island. Maybe that doesn't sound very impressive, but it's a lot of land. And he owns it in 18 different states. And it's not just him, of course. Nearly 40% of all the U.S. farmland is now owned by non-farmers. What are they? You know, they end up renting it to actual farmers. And, of course, so they control that rent, so that becomes a significant expense for the real farmers. And foreign investors, it's not just Bill Gates and other U.S. billionaires. Foreign investors now own about 46 million acres of U.S. farmland, 46 million acres. That's 4% of all the farmland in the U.S. That may seem like a little bit, but it's seems like a lot to me, and it's growing. There are some states like Iowa, like Nebraska, that have stronger anti-corporate and foreign ownership of farmland laws, but more states could use them. So besides Gates, of course, Jeff Bezos, he's the 25th largest landowner in the U.S. He owns about 400,000 acres, and that's not just farmland. He owns other stuff as well. It's a problem. It's a problem because, again, there are just under 2 million farms in the U.S., and the average farm is around 450 acres. In Iowa, when we were colonizing this country, when land was first divided up, again, among white people, the average acreage was 160. I think that was pretty much your lot. It was 160 acres. So right now, the average size is 450 acres, and that includes a lot of smaller farms, direct market farms. We know farms here in central Iowa that are thousands of acres in size. So again, 2 million farms today in the U.S. Less than 100 years ago, there were 6 million farms. So we've lost 65% of our farms in less than 100 years. And because of a lot of different things, a lot of policy changes, a lot of incentives and priorities from the federal government, and because of people like Gates and Bezos and foreign owners of farmland, the family farmers being squeezed out. You know, you can't, when billionaires come in and try to buy land, you know, they drive up the price, and family farmers often just can't afford that. They lose that bidding war, and they end up having to rent the land instead of owning the land. And to give you an idea of how big the price of farmland has changed here in Iowa, this is according to an Iowa State University study a couple of years back. Farmland back in 2001 was $2,000 an acre. Now, that's on average. I mean, some is cheaper. The best cropland with the highest corn suitability rating was probably a bunch more. But on average, $2,000 an acre, 2001, has gone up to $11,500 an acre now. That's in just 25 years. That's huge. That is a huge increase. So why does Bill Gates want to own all this land? Well, he calls himself an environmentalist. he wrote that although climate change will have serious consequences, particularly for people in the poorest countries, it will not lead to humanity's demise. People will be able to live and thrive in most places on Earth for the foreseeable future. Okay, Bill, that's not what scientists are saying. In fact, I think this was in either the Lever or the Intercept. They called him out on that. I'll read you what they wrote. Quote, billionaire environmentalist Bill Gates has changed his tune when it comes to the climate. In a new memo, the Microsoft co-founder throws doubt on theories of global warming and claims that rising temperatures won't lead to humanity's demise, chastising doomsday appraisals of climate change. Gates' sudden flip-flop comes as big tech firms ramp up artificial intelligence expenditures and electricity-guzzling data centers. And make no mistake about it, guzzling data centers has something to do with this. I mean, Gates boasts that he's offset his carbon footprint with carbon credits. And, you know, we've talked about carbon credits on this program before. They are an absolute joke. You know, the carbon offset movement is, I think it's a scam. You know, it's a way for those with the huge yachts and private jets and massive homes to feel good about their excess. And when it comes to Bill Gates, I mean, look at, I mean, we're talking excess on steroids. Eight homes. And that those properties include a mansion in Medina. That mansion is 66,000 square feet. So, you know, if it was 6,000, I'd say, well, that's too much. But 66,000 square foot mansion. It includes 7 bedrooms, 24 bathrooms. You could poop in a different bathroom every day, nearly. You know, 6 kitchens, a 60-foot swimming pool, a trampoline room, a library, a movie theater, and a 23-car garage. I mean, I'm sorry, Bill Gates. You know, I'm not interested in hearing what you have to say about climate change. You know, but okay, let's continue with his own justification, right? His key point is that from the standpoint of improving lives, quote, I mean, using more energy is a good thing because it is so closely correlated with economic growth. Okay, so now I think we're getting somewhere with this now. It's really about economic growth. Now, Gates is all about high-tech stuff, you know. I mean, it's high-tech is a key driver for how the billionaires plan to get even richer, okay? His website, where he promotes this new perspective on climate change and this call for using more energy because we need more economic growth, it includes a photo. And it's a picture of a family, maybe in Africa, I'm guessing, it doesn't say. They're living in front of a very simple wooden home. There's a woman in front. She looks healthy. She looks happy. There's a healthy flock of chickens there, including some young chicks. And the caption reads, "Climate actions need to prioritize improving life for people in low-income countries." Okay, I have no trouble with that. But why are you showing this, a happy woman living in a simple home that's not 66,000 square feet and does not have 23 garages? Why are you criticizing that? She's living a simple, sustainable life. Maybe they're poor, but she doesn't look unhealthy. She's not malnourished. The chickens look fine. So it's really, you know, it's your definition of economic development, which as we have seen across the world in the last 100 years, economic development, European and American style, is often pretty destructive of local cultures, of local food systems, of the local environment. So, you know, Bill Gates, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. And I wish you would stop buying our farmland. Our farmland does not need to be stockpiled by billionaires, by foreign corporations, by foreign countries even. I'm going to close with a quote from the New York Times here. Actually, this is a letter to the editor of the New York Times. It was posted by somebody from Los Angeles. Quote, "We are at a sad moment in American history. We as Americans need to come together to save our republic and ourselves. What's truly divided us is rich versus poor. Everything else, red versus blue, rural versus urban, is background noise used by the rich to divide us." And that's a lot of what motivates me. It's what motivated me to do the Save America March. It's really what I found confirmed in my conversations along the 220-mile length of my march. So, you know, back to my Trump-voting evangelical Christian friend that I mentioned in the first part of this segment, you know, if we can agree that billionaires are at the root of America's rot, then maybe there's hope that we can come together to do something about it. This is Ed Fallon. I'll be back with you in a minute after a short break.
Oh, I got plenty of nerding, and nerding's plenty for me. I got no car, I got no mule, I got no misery. Hey, folks with plenty of plenty, got a lock on the door. Afraid somebody's going to rob them while they're out of making more. What for? I got no lock on the door, that's no way to be. They can steal the rug from the floor. That's okay with me, cause the things that I prize, the stars in the skies, all are free. Oh, I got plenty of nerding, and nerding's plenty for me.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our partners, including Catholic Peace Ministry, whose focus is on nuclear disarmament, the war between Israel and Hamas, the war in Ukraine, and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. All right, Ed Fallon with you here, folks. If you are involved with a nonprofit organization that leans, quote, left, and I, you know, when you're a 501c3, you're supposed to be focused on educational stuff. I guess you can have a left or right perspective to your educational work. I work with Climate March. We also have an agricultural nonprofit called Birds and Bees Urban Farm. It's hard to say what's going to happen here, but, you know, Trump issued this this thing back in September called a National Security Presidential Memorandum. And we've mentioned it before, but to get into it a little bit more, just a bit more here, he's directing federal law enforcement and other agencies. So he's turning loose the full power of the federal government to investigate and disrupt any and all left of center nonprofit organizations that are seen as opposing his agenda. I mean, it's the memorandum identifies a vague list of First Amendment protected political beliefs as indications of domestic terrorism. And what does that list include? It includes anything that's anti-American. Define that for me. Anything that's anti-capitalist, anti-Christianity. Quote, extremism on migration, race, and gender, and opposition to, quote, traditional American views on family, religion, and morality. Can that not cover everything that could be construed as, quote, on the left? And with Trump coming after Antifa, which again is, that's very instructive, right? A group that calls itself anti-fascist is being targeted. Well, you would think it would be by fascists, and I think maybe you can make that argument, right? So, but they're trying to identify Antifa broadly enough, and again, it's easy to do that because Antifa is not an actual organization. There are no Antifa leaders. There is no Antifa headquarters. There is no Antifa, you know, foundation of any kind other than just a concept, a movement, and like movements that are that broad, different cells, if you would, do different things at different times. But here, you know, as Trump gets, I think what they're going to do, if they haven't done it already by the time you hear this program, they're going to be classifying Antifa as a foreign terrorist threat. That opens it up to a whole range of criticisms and pushbacks and action. And again, if it's so vaguely defined, if so vaguely structured on its own, it's going to be easy for the Trump administration to start identifying any other organization that they don't like as being associated with Antifa. This is really dangerous, folks. This is really, really dangerous. And I hope people across the political spectrum can wake up to what's going on, because if this becomes the law, and at some point, or just law of the practice, I guess what happens in reality is more important than what the law is anymore. If this becomes what happens, you know, I mean, and the administration shifts, changes, you know, this could be used against anybody. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens. It'll be disturbing to see what happens, is my suspicion. I want to look to Utah for a second here. And I want to thank Lee Camp for pointing this out. I was not aware that Utah had pretty much ended homelessness back in 2015. And they did that with the radical concept of providing more affordable housing. I mean, who knew that providing affordable housing would eliminate homelessness? Lee writes, quote, Utah achieved the almost end of chronic homelessness with an incredible, ingenious, unprecedented, unfathomable approach that gave every chronically homeless person a home. Yay. So it was reported pretty far and wide that the Los Angeles Times had a headline that said, Utah is winning the war on chronic homelessness with Housing First program. National Public Radio wrote, quote, Utah reduced chronic homelessness by 91%. And then, because this is Lee Camp, and he's a comedian who does great news commentary. He said, Fox News had a headline, Dirty Mud People Given Free Marxist Homes for Free Just for Being Mud People. Okay, he made that one up. All right, so Lee sadly points out that the state officials in Utah, realizing that their plan had worked really well, they ended the program. Now, we've seen this happen with other programs. Oh, wait, funding ways of ending teen pregnancy, that's working. Oh, let's not fund that anymore. Funding anti-smoking initiatives, oh, it seems to be working. Well, let's just stop funding it now. So they did that, which is really sad. And now they may be going the opposite direction because Donald Trump, President Trump, has come up with an idea to create homeless internment camps. And who knows how that's going to go. I want to talk a little bit more about something similar to that a little bit later, but we'll never end homelessness completely until we end, among other things, the huge income inequality that has become prominent in this culture. We've talked about that earlier. We talk about that a lot. But as Lee points out, there are 15 million empty homes in the U.S., none of them being used to house people who need a roof over their heads. There are tens of thousands of military veterans who are homeless. And on any given night, 1.2 million children are either homeless or semi-homeless, by semi-homeless, sleeping on someone's couch. So, you know, it's a problem. And we could probably, like Utah did, fix 90% of it with affordable housing and, you know, the right kind of support programs, you know, mental health counseling, food assistance, medical assistance. But no, we're going to try to incarcerate them, I guess, internment camps. We'll see how that goes. One thing we might look at to see how it goes is the ICE detention cells that have been used more prominently and more aggressively than in any previous incarnation. Back in June, I think it was, there was a change in public policy. It used to be that you could not hold someone in one of these detention cells for more than 12 hours. I mean, these are cells that have the concrete rooms and no beds. And, even 12 hours, just a concrete floor and nothing else, and maybe you're not the only one in the cell, that's not good. But back in June, the limit was raised to 3 days, from 12 hours to 3 days. You could be 3 days in a room, a cell, just stone tat, stone floor, no bed, nothing. That's inhumane. That is cruel and unusual punishment. And that's some of what ICE is doing right now. Now, what else is ICE up to? Well, look no further than our neighboring state here, Iowa. We consider Chicago practically a suburb of Davenport, but it's been a horrible place lately. I've been getting reports from friends there. I think the a report from the New York Times by Julie Bozeman back in the middle of October. And this continues even as we speak today. But she wrote that, quote, during a recent run near Lake Michigan, I watched a black SUV make a U-turn and chase down three young men. Two armed immigration agents, their eyes peeking out from behind their balaclavas, jumped out and approached them. One asked what visas they held. H-1B, they responded, looking bewildered. That's the visa for foreign workers with special expertise. Nothing that I could see would have attracted the attention of the agents except for the fact that the men had brown skin. After questioning them, the agents let them go. And this scene is now unfolding across Chicago every day. So if you've seen any of the video footage, ICE officers are using, they're getting more and more aggressive. They're using pepper balls, smoke bombs, hurling tear gas at the general public, at protesters, journalists, even at Chicago police officers, often, without any advance warning that that's what they're going to do. They've been hanging out outside of schools. Some principals have responded by doing, quote, soft lockdowns. In other words, keeping the kids in the classrooms until the agents are gone. Last month in Chicago, ICE tried to arrest a father after a daycare drop-off, and the guy was shot and killed. I don't know all the backstory there, but why are they hanging outside schools in the first place? So now, some schools are using neighborhood volunteers at parents' request to escort Latino children home. The volunteers are white. They're safe because they're white. So ICE is also showing up at restaurants. We had that happen here in Iowa City. Most of the ICE activity in Iowa has been far more limited than it has been in Chicago, of course, and mostly in eastern Iowa, Cedar Rapids in particular, but a little bit in Iowa City. So in restaurants, a lot of undocumented immigrants work there. And workers, they tend to be afraid to leave their homes. Some of them are even locking up. Some allow only one customer in at a time as a way to, kind of guard against ICE. ICE is also showing up in public places. It's not really surprising, I suppose, that they're targeting Chicago. Chicago is, after all, a sanctuary city. I would point out that here in Iowa, Iowa City is also a sanctuary city. Again, that's maybe why we're seeing activity in eastern Iowa, but again, not to this extent. So that ticks off Donald Trump. He doesn't like sanctuary cities. And for one reason, 20% of the population of Chicago were born outside the U.S. And overall, the population in Chicagoland is pretty supportive of the immigrant community. And, local police officers, law enforcement does not participate in immigration efforts. They don't help ICE by asking suspects their immigration status. So, of course, the governor, J.B. Pritzker, and the mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, are regularly, pushing back against Trump's mobilization of the National Guard and ICE to Chicago. Trump's response, quote, they should be in jail for failing to protect ICE officers. Protect ICE officers? Really? Okay. I don't know where this goes. We did see Trump threatening to send the National Guard to San Francisco, but apparently one of his buddies in San Francisco said, please don't, and that was all it took. So I guess if you're listening to this program and you're a buddy with Donald Trump, please make a reasonable request and see if he'll go along with that. I have a feeling that's one reason we've seen in recent days a favorable response by the Trump administration to the loss of the soybean farmers market, where China basically had not bought a single soybean from the U.S. And I don't know if anybody really knows all the details about that, but of course, just last week, China agreed to buy not quite as much as they normally do from the U.S., but they are going to buy some soybeans. And I don't know whether Trump is helping to subsidize that. I mean, he's already helping Argentina keep their prices down by giving them $40 million if they promise to keep Milei in power. So maybe there's some money behind that as well to make the soybean crop in the U.S. more profitable, more appealing to China. But I do know that I suspect that people who are just focused on their own bottom line are going to say, "Okay, whew, relief. I'm glad Trump took care of that." But again, it's a really sloppy way to take care of a problem that you created. And I hope people continue to look beyond their own situation, because what's happening again with ICE officials? I mean, there was a Democratic candidate for Congress who happens to be Palestinian and was peaceably protesting against some of what ICE was doing in Chicago. She is now being indicted by the Trump administration. So, you know, I don't know how much further this is going to go, folks, but it's disturbing. And I'm sorry that most of what I talk about tends to be disturbing, but I'm afraid that's what has to happen in this time and place, because we are at a real risk of losing our democracy, and we all need to push back every which way possible. That said, this is Ed Fallon. I'm going to take a short break, and I'll be back in a minute with more conversation on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
All right, hey folks, welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here. Hey, thanks to Story County Veterinary Clinic, our sponsor, because, we rely heavily on the support of local businesses that believe in what we're doing. Dr. Kim Holding there has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. You can learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, again, I apologize for having so many bad news stories. We got to know about this stuff. We got to know about it. It should not, I mean, yeah, maybe it's a little depressing, but it should motivate us to take action. And action can be attending a rally, a march. I think one of the most important actions you can take is changing how you live on the earth and who you buy what you need from. You know, if you've got an Amazon Prime account, I hope you delete it today, because there are locally owned businesses that can benefit from your patronage. And having somebody in your town who owns their own business or works for a locally owned businesses, that's going to be a lot. That's a lot stronger than helping Jeff Bezos, you know, build another bunker or facilitate his departure to the moon or wherever he's going to fly off to. So here's one that I, admittedly, this is harder to work on. It's harder to deal with. You know, Trump has directed the Pentagon to, quote, immediately, whatever that means, immediately match other nuclear powers in their testing of nuclear weapons. And he specifically cited China and Russia. But here's the kicker. Neither Russia nor China has conducted a nuclear test since the 1990s. And neither has the U.S. So this is new. This is big. This is disturbing. Trump wrote on Truth Social, which I think should be called Lie Antisocial, but anyway, he wrote, quote, "Because of other countries' testing programs, I have instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. That process will begin immediately." Now, timing-wise, that post came less than an hour before Trump met Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, in South Korea last week. So, well, great timing there, guy. Apparently, I did not come up in conversation. But again, 1992, that's the last time the U.S., China, and Russia held a nuclear test. Under Bill Clinton, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was signed. Now, there had been an earlier partial test ban accord signed under, I believe, Kennedy, maybe Johnson. But the full impact of a nuclear test ban happened in the mid-1990s. And it's important to recognize that there used to be, 60,000 nuclear weapons on the planet? And there are, quote, I'm putting it in quotes, only about 17,000 now. Of course, only, even just one nuclear weapon could ruin your whole day. So it's really, we have a long ways to go to get to sanity and safety. But resuming nuclear testing is a really, really bad idea. And I will say, a point of personal reflection here, this is how I got involved in social change, in political policy. I was living in Ireland. My girlfriend at the time and I were farming. We were farming my uncle's land. They had both passed away. And my grandmother, my dad owned the land at that point, and we were living subsistence farm lives on a small 30-acre plot in Roscommon County. And I learned about Irish CND, Irish Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and we decided to get involved a little bit. We didn't do a lot. We were farming. We don't have a lot of time, but we did go to Galway to join a protest organized by CND. When Ronald Reagan came to Galway to collect an honorary degree, we thought that was kind of ridiculous. The more interesting thing we got involved with was a group of Irish CND members who pushed a baby carriage from the very northern part of the country, Donegal, all the way down to the south, to the town of Tipperary, where Ronald Reagan was coming to claim his direct descendants from the great Irish patriot Brian Boru. So what does the baby carriage have to do with that? Well, Reagan's stated mission for being in Ireland was to convince the Irish to allow the U.S. to place MX missiles in Ireland. He was also there, probably even more importantly, to shore up the Irish-American vote in the next election. This is 1984. So we took about a 25-mile stretch of that march from, I guess you'd call this my first march, from Donegal to Tipperary, and pushed that baby carriage with that papier-mâché replica of a MX missile with a sign on it saying "Return to Sender." And the Reagan's visit to Ireland proved to be very helpful in terms of his winning the Irish-American vote. But to the credit of the Irish, they said no thank you to the MX missile. And so to this day, there are no U.S. missiles stationed in Ireland. Now, when I came back to the U.S. in the fall of December, November maybe of 1984, I got involved with the nuclear freeze movement here in Iowa, helping to organize freeze walks. Those were walks of 10 to 20 miles to help raise money for the freeze movement. My back was so bad then, I didn't walk. I just helped promote it and generated interest in donating to the cause. And then in 1986, when the Great Peace March launched, I got involved with that, coordinating the march's stops in Iowa. And there were 600 people marching by the time they got to Iowa. It was huge. But then after that was over, the focus of my work was on the nuclear test ban movement. And I led a delegation once to the nuclear test site, where 1,000 of us were arrested for trespassing onto the nuclear test site with the intention of trying to stop a test. We knew we weren't going to do that. I was actually surprised how far I was able to walk before I was arrested. We were treated reasonably well, handcuffed, but then put on buses. And then, you know, I think the handcuffs came off once we sat for the three-hour ride to the furthest end of the county. But I did, you know, after that, I continued to do lots of things to try to help move the anti-testing conversation forward. I think one of the most effective things that we did here in Iowa was we got about 120, I want to say, churches that were part of a program called For Whom the Bell Tolls. And I know that's not an original, but it's something people are familiar with. And the idea was that every time there was a nuclear test, they would ring their bells. Or if they didn't have a bell, somehow they would announce that a test had happened and that people should be concerned about this. Because anytime there was a test, it meant a new weapon system was coming into play. And that was a cause for concern. And again, we had 120 churches just in Iowa that were doing that. That's significant. And you might say, well, how did you know there was going to be a nuclear test? That's a really good question. I'm glad you asked. This is back in 1987, 88, 89. And how we knew was there was a network established that involved a Swedish peace organization that was monitoring Soviet tests, USSR, Russia. There was another group that monitored Chinese and French nuclear tests in the South Pacific and elsewhere in the Chinese desert. And there was a group called American Peace Test, which was stationed in Nevada, monitoring nuclear testing there. And when there was a nuclear test, each of these groups, these organizations monitoring them, would send out an email. And yes, you heard me right, an email in 1987. They would send out an email that would announce that the test had just occurred. And that was our cue to use our network to let the public know. And I just said email, 1987. And yes, you are talking to one of the first people in America to be on email. The Luddite Ed Fallon. Yes, that's me. And that was back when you would take your phone line, unplug it from your phone. It would still be plugged into the wall. You need your phone jack. And then you would plug it into a modem attached to your computer. And then you would wait forever while it dialed up. And of course, you could type a lot faster than the letters would appear on the screen. So you had to be in no hurry. But every day, actually twice a day, morning and evening, we would check email to see if there had been a nuclear test by either the U.S., Britain, which also used the U.S. nuclear testing site, Russia, China, France. Those were primarily the countries that were testing back in the late 80s, early 90s. And again, it was called the Iowa Peace Network, Iowa Peace Net, actually. And there were, there were four or five of us in the entire state who were on email at the time, using that system to monitor nuclear tests. And then when it came to actually sending out the notice, you know, again, we couldn't use email because no one else had it. And we had 120 churches, so we wanted to do this as quickly as possible. We would print an 8.5 by 11 sheet of, you know, cardstock with that you could cut into four parts, and each there would be a postcard, basically four postcards. And we would talk about what had happened, where the test was, what kind of bomb, as much as we knew about it, and a call to action. Please ring your bells or do whatever you do to alert your congregation that there has been a test. And then we would cut that paper in fourths and stick a postage stamp on it, which was really cheap back then, and send it out, and they'd get it within a couple days. So yeah, there was a little bit of a lag time, but surprisingly very little considering how far removed that is from the current state of electronic communications. So, you know, not only were the churches educating their congregations, but we had all kinds of media coverage, including national media coverage of the movement. And there were other states doing this as well. I think we first got the idea from a nuclear testing group, anti-nuclear testing group in Ohio. Anyway, it's happening again. Maybe. I hope not. I hope Trump is just blowing more smoke, like, I'm going to buy Greenland, or Canada will be our 51st state. We'll see, though. We don't know whether he's blowing smoke or really means it this time. But we'll see. We'll see where this goes. But it's important to know what's going on. It's important to realize, to remember that nuclear testing is not a good sign. It means that new systems are being developed, and that's been happening. But they're being... And beyond that, blowing up a nuclear bomb anywhere, whether it's an island in the South Pacific, a desert in Nevada, the tundra in Russia, that's never a good thing. That's never a good thing. Somebody is going to get hurt. And we've talked about how the downwinders in our own country have been affected by nuclear testing in Nevada. So again, I encourage you to pay attention to this stuff, to weigh in as you can with a letter to the editor. Maybe we should think about reviving the church bell tolling movement. That was pretty powerful. But we'll see. I'll be reporting as soon as, if there's any development on this, it's something I'm going to report on to you, because again, I've got a long history in this and it means a lot to me. And I think it means a lot to our movement for sanity in this country to make sure this doesn't happen. Hey, got to take a short break. When I come back, Kathy Burns is going to join me. It is time for our November Garden Q&A. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum, and thanks to psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. Hey, Ed Fallon with you, and Kathy Burns joining me. We're going to be talking about kind of answering questions regarding November garden activity. But first, hey, the Drake Park Orchard. 2.5 years of working to convince the city this was a good idea, and it's happening.
It happened on...
Last week.
Happened on, what, Wednesday of last week?
Yeah.
And what a thrill. And about 30 people were there in the park that is in the Drake University neighborhood. And it is a neighborhood of need, and it's a beautiful park. It's always got children playing, adults supervising, and they're going to be 36 if they all survive, fruit trees that will begin bearing fruit within a few years, and that is for public picking.
Yeah. So I was surprised that some of the trees were pretty large. I mean, most of them were small, with a compact root ball, but some of them were bare root, mm-hmm. which normally you plant in the spring. So I'm hoping those do okay.
Well, and they had Trees Forever is the group who sourced the trees for the city and this project. And they had trouble finding you know, the potted trees at this late in the season when they got the list and went through it and decided, determined exactly how many trees there would be. And they got what they could get, and we're going to just do our best to kind of keep tabs on those trees and hope they produce. So it was a cool experience. My favorite part might have been when one of the council members, Carl Voss, introduced us and said that we were, and he paused, and he said, persistent with our work with trying to get this going.
I corrected him. I said, no, we're not persistent. We're annoying.
And that's what it takes. If you're working for positive change, sometimes you have to keep
politely
at it.
Politely annoying.
Politely annoying. So that actually leads us to our first question.
Okay.
And the first question was, what is the latest we can plant fruit trees?
Well, last week in Iowa. Who knows? I mean, where else? You know, we're already in a more southern growing zone.
We are.
The first frost date is 15 days later than it used to be.
Well, I know that the people at the city worked hard to get this in before the freeze came on, and to do it this year instead of putting it off to spring, that was a big relief.
Yeah.
So it depends on your freeze dates and how warm the soil is, how moist the soil is, but later and later, and fall is a good time for
tree planting. I would say early November, you're probably pushing it.
You are.
Yeah. Hey, another question. Someone says, I'm interested in storing potatoes in my unheated garage. It'll get pretty cold in there, definitely below freezing. Do they need air circulation? There's a lot in that question.
There is a lot in that question. And, you know, if the garage freezes, the very first thought I would have would be, no, you should not store them in a place where it's going to freeze.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to make sure they don't freeze, you do that.
They absolutely can't freeze, yeah.
And we have the best luck, I think, putting them into a pit in the ground and lining that with some straw and making sure that we get them out in time.
Yeah, it's like a mini root cellar. It's an idea that I got based on what the Irish call a clamp.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in Ireland, the frost never goes that deep.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Iowa, it can go way down. So we bury, the lowest level is 3 feet in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we put straw on the bottom, then potatoes, and this year we put potatoes and beets in there.
Beets.
We've had beets do well in the pit before. And then another layer of straw, then a layer of dirt,
mm-hmm.
then another layer of straw, and then your next layer of vegetables.
And on up.
And then when you get to the top, when you don't just cover it flat, you build a big, you know, triangle, a big mound of dirt on top. And then that gets covered with leaves
mm-hmm.
eventually. So you've got a pretty big sized, a pretty deep piece of ground. It keeps them really in good shape, and they don't freeze.
I think as per circulation, air circulation, you do want, whether you store them in a cool part of your basement, in a pit in the ground, you don't want them all squished up next to each other. You want air between them, if you can, to keep them from, if one rots, then it will rot its neighbor. And make sure that you get that space vented also so that they don't rot.
Like with our pit, we have a wick made of mm-hmm. straw that... And onion and garlic braids,
any straw type thing
that basically that wick will draw any gases or
mm-hmm.
air, you know, used air up to the surface.
So they don't.
And then in the basement, we have a fan on for our onions to keep them from getting in too still of an environment.
Mm-hmm.
Someone wanted to know, Kathy, if they can cut and gut acorn squash and freeze it.
Yeah.
Cut and gut.
I like that phrase. And yeah, you should not just freeze your raw squash. I believe you want to roast it or cook it in some way. And after whether you peel that acorn and...
It sounds like that's what they want to do is just freeze it raw, which is not a good idea.
That will invite too much freeze, and it will squish once it thaws out.
Speaking of, back to root vegetables, somebody asked, I planted parsnips and leeks near my sweet potatoes, and they weren't as big as in the past.
And that's a very interesting use of land. I would guess that it has to do with the difference in the water needs for leeks and parsnips and sweet potatoes. I think they're all different. Leeks would be your biggest water hogs in there. And they want consistent, good, hard drinks. Not hard drinks. I don't like whiskey or anything. But they like consistent and tons of water, like celery.
Quick last question. Mm-hmm. I'm new to canning and gardening. Because we were going to have a frost, I picked all my green tomatoes. What can I do with them?
Let them ripen. Bring them in and lay them out to put them in a box together and let them ripen.
What about fried green tomatoes?
You can do fried green tomatoes if you're in. That's fine. That's good food.
Kathy, thanks for joining us. Folks, thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our production team, which includes Kathy and myself, Ed Fallon, and Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, and Charles Goldman. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, real estate agent Joe Henry, and Architecture by Synthesis. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.